are always being assessed. Instead of putting our first or second team in the watch stations, we put in our third or fourth string. These people were our future, likely to be on the ship for the next 4 or 5 years. So it paid great dividends for us to show the experts how well they performed. And perform they did. According to the assessors, our third and fourth string teams were better than 90% of the other ship's first stringers. The assessors were amazed at Benfold's proficiency and readiness, both short and long term, and said it was obvious that we had put enormous effort into training. For me, it was all a huge relief. The struggle had paid off. My crew felt a different relief. They were just glad it was over. Counsel continuously and honestly. One of the most difficult tasks for any manager is counseling his or her employees at the yearly or semi-annual evaluation. The Navy's annual evaluations can make or break a career. What worked best for me was to continuously counsel the people I was going to evaluate. Unfortunately, we have to rank everyone against his or her peers, which can cause those ranked at the bottom to feel resentful. My advice is to remove the guesswork and let people know what the criteria are going to be so they won't be surprised. Skipping this preparation only leads to heartache and discontent. For my mid-level managers, my officers and chief petty officers, I set up clear and concise guidelines as to what I expected from them. I told them that I expected them to be experts in their own fields and that I would check on whether or not they were. Furthermore, they were expected to take on a project or two that would improve the ship's quality of life, or a military process that affected the entire organization. My theory is that when people see their contemporaries undertaking big projects, they will understand that doing so gets you a top evaluation. It's purely a matter of a person's own ambition. If you want to climb the ladder, you have to do more than your specific job. You have to do things that affect the lives of others in the organization. The key to a successful evaluation is whether or not your people are surprised the day you give them their grades. If they're surprised, then clearly you have not done a good job of setting their expectations and providing feedback throughout the entire year. If you're communicating expectations and feedback on a continuous basis throughout the year, you will minimize, if not eliminate, people's surprise when you give them the final evaluation. I gave consistent feedback at regular intervals throughout the year, formally on a quarterly basis, but also as part of the daily routine. Whenever people did something great, I let them know. Whenever they came up short, I did not let it fester until the end of the evaluation period. I got it out in the open right away. More than anything else, your people appreciate honesty from you. Even if they're doing something poorly, it's better to get it on the table early in the process so they have time to fix it. That's the key to being a good leader, ongoing counseling, and consistent honesty. No one likes being involved in an adversarial or confrontational situation. But, from time to time, it's inevitable. That's why we get paid the big bucks. Don't try to hide behind anyone else. Stand up to the plate. When it is time to inform the bottom performers that, in fact, that's what they are, I have found that asking them how they would rate their own performances is effective. Most recognize that in relation to their peers, they are at the bottom of the curve. Whenever I had deficient performers, I always laid out a game plan for them to improve. I'd bring them in, tell them what their problems were, what they needed to do to correct them, and provide training if they needed it. I would give them a deadline by which I expected them to have their deficiencies corrected. If necessary, I would clearly lay out in advance what would happen if they didn't. I'm proud that I didn't have to fire or reassign anyone, but I was prepared to do so if I had to. All managers must be ready to shed poor performers, but only after you have given them a chance. You must be open and honest with them, clarify their deficiencies, and how they can overcome them. And finally, you must spell out the stick. What will happen if they don't address those problems in a timely manner? I went through that process with Lieutenant Jason Michael, who came to Benfold as chief engineer, one of the most critical positions on the ship. He was enormously talented and had been chief engineer on USS Reed, where he had developed a reputation as a fire breather. I was very concerned about him because I didn't want him to ruin the atmosphere we had created on the ship. First, I gave him a break. Since he had spent the previous Christmas away from his family because he was on deployment to the Persian Gulf, I modified his training to let him have Christmas at home and meet us in Australia. The officer he was relieving had been on Benfold for 3 years and was burned out. The chief engineer may be the most demanding of the five department head jobs, and their tour is only supposed to be 18 months. The Navy was critically short of engineers at the time, so the tour length jumped to 36 months. The previous engineer desperately wanted to get his master's degree at the Navy's postgraduate school in Monterey, California. The program began in September, and he had to be there if he was going to join it. Even though it meant that I would be at sea for almost 100 days without a chief engineer, I decided to take the leap and let him go in September, even though Jason Michael would not arrive until after Christmas. Most people thought I was crazy, but I decided it was the right thing to do. The added benefit was that it would allow me to entrust an ensign, Tom Holcomb, to step up and be the interim chief engineer. To be in a position like this as an ensign is unheard of in the Navy, and Tom did exactly what I thought he would do. He rose to the occasion and did a superb job. The bonus? When Jason finally arrived, I had two officers fully capable of filling the post. When Jason showed up in Australia, he came to see me within 2 hours. He announced that he didn't agree with my leadership style, that it would not work with engineers because they need to be kicked in the butt instead of led. He said he could not operate under Benfold's conditions. It boggled my mind. I just could not believe anyone would have the audacity to say something like that on day one, just reporting to work. After recovering from my shock, I told him that, oh yes, he could achieve those results on this ship, and that I expected him to do just that. I also told him what would happen to him if he didn't. I would kick him off the ship, with a fitness report that would send him to repair diesels in the Aleutian Islands. That got his attention, but it took him a while to actually understand and believe that what he had heard was actually true. He had been on the ship for about a week when we suffered a major engineering casualty. When he ran to the central control station, he found no officers or chief petty officers there. Traditionally, any problem could be solved if you threw enough officers and chiefs at it. He passed the word for his top two assistants, Master Chief Mike Nail and Ensign Tom Holcomb, to report to him. And when they did, he berated them for not being there in an emergency. Master Chief Nail told him the facts of life on Benfold and that the crew felt ownership of their work. What do you want me to do, fix it myself? Mike asked. That's what we pay these people to do. We have trained them. They can fix it. It would be demotivating for them if I had to go down and fix every casualty. It also would never prepare us for success. It shocked Jason Michael that his master chief would talk to him this way. Even more shocking was the fact that some of the lowest-ranking people in his department fixed a major breakdown. His world was rocked, too, because I wasn't standing over his shoulder demanding a status report every 5 minutes. I didn't need to be, because I knew that the engineers felt ownership of the ship and would do their best to fix it. They knew I was concerned and wanted to be informed, but they also knew that I would wait for them to tell me. Jason will say that that was one of the biggest lessons he learned. He started realizing that you can actually lead engineers and treat them with respect. And he became one of the best officers and leaders I have ever seen. Words cannot possibly convey what a truly phenomenal leader he became. Chapter 11. Generate Unity. One of my harder tasks was getting people to accept that we were all, in this case literally, in the same boat. Either we would support one another or the whole ship could be in critical trouble that no one could escape. One of the toughest things for organizations to accomplish is to get people to set aside personal differences and work for the good of everyone involved. I don't care to have the best weapons department of any ship in the Navy if the engineers can't make the propeller turn and get us to the battle. If that's the case, we are one of the worst ships. The task of the leader is to assemble the best team possible, train it, then figure out the best way to get the members to work together for the good of the organization. After I had been with the Secretary of Defense for about a year, we returned from an overseas trip and were critiquing what we had accomplished. I summoned up the courage to inquire why he had hired me in the first place. "Why did you choose me over those most highly qualified candidates?" I asked. Dr. Perry responded, "Mike, I have been in both government and business for over 40 years. I can hire the smartest people around. But I have found what works the best is a staff that works together and backstops each other. The staff decided that you were the one they could work with the best." Perhaps the most malignant obstacle to forming a cohesive unit is also the U.S. military's worst-kept secret: its inability to end racial and gender discrimination. Contrary to Pentagon hopes and hype, racism persists and sexual harassment is pandemic in nearly every military unit, land, sea, or air. In fact, this shouldn't be surprising. The military, like any organization, reflects the larger culture of which it is a part. Treating people with dignity and respect is not only morally right, but also highly practical and productive. Unity became the fundamental purpose of my leadership model. We achieved that goal because we learned how to make people want to belong to our 310-member club, ready to give their best to a fair-dealing ship that clearly valued them, no matter what color or sex they were. Forget diversity, train for unity. Shortly after I took command of Benfold, I set out to find out exactly how dreadful the climate on the ship was. I decided to read the portion of a survey that addressed what people of different ethnic groups thought about one another. In the spirit of endorsing equal opportunity, these mandatory surveys are part of the status report that an outgoing commander hands over to his or her successor. I asked for the results. Turns out, they didn't shine a very favorable light on an aspect of the ship's operations. As such, no one was too keen to talk about the survey. But it's been my experience in management that while good news makes you feel warm inside, it's the negative news that makes you learn and helps improve your performance at your job. Among the various issues that were brought up, a big one dealt with the sailors' perception. Some women felt there was sexual harassment on the ship. Some minorities felt there was racial prejudice. And some white males even felt there was favoritism toward women and minorities. That's a trifecta that's tough to overcome. My first move was to cancel our diversity training program. I could have been fired for that. But in my view, it was common sense that any program that produced such awful results was clearly ineffective. I had no intention of allowing anything ineffective on Benfold. In its place, I substituted unity training, concentrating on people's likenesses and our common goals rather than differences. Unity begins by recognizing common interests. A ship of 310 people who looked and acted just like me would probably be one of the worst ships in the history of the Navy. If you surround yourself with people exactly like yourself, you run the dangerous risk of groupthink, and no one has the creativity to come up with new ideas. The goal is not to create a group of clones culturally engineered to mimic one another. Rather, unity is about maximizing uniqueness and channeling that toward the common goals of the group. Too often, individuals champion their individuality as an excuse to do whatever they want, whenever they want. That is no formula for success in battle or in business. As Benjamin Franklin put it when he defied the British and signed the Declaration of Independence on July 4, 1776, "We must indeed all hang together, or assuredly, we shall all hang separately." In some ways, I base unity training on the awful example of the Washington Redskins in 1996, when the team fielded a jumble of highly talented, overpaid individuals who looked like Super Bowl champions, but only won a few games all season. Fast forward to the year 2000. The Redskins had the highest payroll in the National Football League, but still could not make it to the playoffs. What I wanted was what the Redskins needed and Franklin inspired, a team of highly talented individuals that played as one. Unity Training was one of the few programs I chose not to delegate. I conducted it myself. I reached out to each of the ship's 24 divisions and told them how I felt. First, there was no place for racial or gender prejudice on Benfold. To deny their existence would be foolish, but to let such attitudes show on my ship was anathema to everything it stood for and grounds for immediate and severe disciplinary action. I also led with those very same values. All too often, our words say one thing and our actions quite another. There is no such thing as a truly level playing field, I told them. But we were going to work damn hard to make ours as fair as possible. Everyone has strengths and weaknesses. No one is perfect, including the commanding officer. I would applaud their strengths and help them overcome their weaknesses. But above all, I wanted them to treat one another with dignity and respect. And though we all want to win at whatever we do, the most important point was how we won, whether we did it in a way that made us proud or ashamed, bigger or smaller. In short, how we got there was just as important as getting there. And if I could stay proud of whatever I did, I told them, so could they, making Benfold a great ship in the process. In my interviews with the crew, I also asked if there was any sexual harassment or racial prejudice being expressed on board. And when I heard about an occurrence, I acted immediately. If you don't intend to act, then don't bother to ask if it is going on. It will only make matters worse. One complicating factor, which is going to take years to overcome, is that the Navy Officer Corps is composed overwhelmingly of white males, while the enlisted men and women include blacks, Latinos, Asian Americans, and other minorities. Inevitably, this was the case on Benfold too. That's the struggle every institution faces. Fortunately, most organizations are finally waking up to the fact that management needs to reflect the makeup of the workforce. This isn't a starry-eyed ideal, but a hard, cold business fact. People need to know that their interests are being represented at the top. More important, people need positive role models, such as William Perry provided for me. It is naive to assume that race and gender play no part in determining who our role models are. There are numerous ships in the Navy today wherein the officer corps is made up entirely of white males. This single fact is keeping those ships from being as good as they possibly can be. I was extremely fortunate that the random personnel generator at the Bureau of Naval Personnel handed me an officer in a chief petty officer corps that reflected the makeup of the crew. It inspired members of the crew to think such a position was possible for them. Little by little, the crew began to buy into my perspective, especially when they saw me backing up my words with actions. We started to improve a little, and I kept walking around the ship, questioning the crew, drawing them out. I'm a big believer in getting resentments and grumbling out in the open, where they can do a lot less damage. Those conversations helped, and so did my efforts to chip away at ingrained behaviors that stem from the military's hierarchy. By such gestures as joining the enlisted people at cookouts, having lunch once a week with the crew on the mess decks, and making sure visiting VIPs got to talk to the crew, I tried to show the officers that in human terms, we were all in this together, and each person was indispensable to the unity of the Benfold team. To me, diversity training had merely made people more aware of their differences. Our unity training focused on common interest and positive reasons to value others instead of a top-down prohibition against devaluing them. It was the difference between being rewarded for good behavior and being punished for bad behavior. In this case, the reward was to become a full-scale shareholder in the Benfold community with all the rights and privileges that membership brought. The payoff was reflected in our equal opportunity surveys. When I departed, only 3% of minorities on board reported any type of racial prejudice, and just 3% of women reported sexual harassment. Of course, that is still 6% too many, but it was a quantum improvement over the overwhelming percentage who had previously reported favoritism, sexual harassment, and racial prejudice. Benfold became a more enlightened ship, but not because I gave long lectures scolding sailors for their racial and gender prejudices. People changed because we proved the benefits of community. They changed because in their hearts, these sailors wanted and needed to belong to a team that cared for its members, at least as well as it cared for its cutting-edge machinery. For the most part, these feelings had never been spoken on Benfold until I voiced them. Articulating the feelings that your people are afraid to speak is a large part of what leaders, including ship captains, do for a living. Deal out punishment strictly but fairly. 3 months after taking command, before I initiated my effort to eliminate racism and sexism on board, I had a disciplinary case that proved a crucible for my Unity training program. We were in Bahrain when a very serious racist incident occurred. Some of my sailors were returning on a Navy bus from an evening of drinking on the base. Two black sailors were singing a loud rap song that included the word nigger. Two white sailors yelled at them to shut up because, according to the white sailors and others on the bus, they were annoying everyone. They didn't stop. When they all got off the bus, hot words were exchanged all the way back to the ship, with one of the white sailors using the N-word. Then a big fight broke out in quarters, during which one sailor threatened to kill another. Eventually, 13 people were involved in trying to break up the brawl. The two black and one white sailor were charged with assault. For me, this was a pivotal event. As the leader in a crisis, I knew that everyone in the organization was watching me very closely, searching for signals that would reveal my priorities. A leader's every action is always scrutinized, and I knew that everything I did in this most difficult case would quickly spread throughout the ship. I knew, too, that my actions would influence the crew's behavior as well as the ship's culture for months, if not longer. As the ship's commander, I was in many ways the court of last resort. When a Navy person breaks an important rule or regulation, he or she is in violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the Navy's equivalent of civilian criminal law. The accused is placed on report and brought before Captain's Mast, a hearing in which the captain functions as judge, jury, and executioner. After an investigation to determine the facts, the captain takes over, and I do mean takes over. It is the captain alone who interrogates the defendant, cross-examines the witnesses, determines guilt or innocence, and decides on acquittal or conviction. For punishment, the captain is authorized to throw miscreants out of the Navy, refer them to a higher military court ashore, restrict them to the ship with onerous duties for 45 days, cut their pay in half for 2 months, reduce them in rank, or even lock them up in the brig on a diet of bread and water for 3 days. In itself, the captain's power is appropriate. Captains have always needed autocratic powers to deal with mutinous sailors. And for sailors in peril on the sea, having someone clearly in charge tends to be comforting. The question, of course, is whether a captain can use this power in ways that win the crew's respect and trust. Neither tyrants nor pushovers have a chance. The best skippers blend fairness and strength, and they learn from life, not just from a book. In this case, the two black sailors had been in trouble before. Earlier in my career, multiple disciplinary proceedings would have been enough reason to throw them out of the Navy immediately. This time, however, I asked Master Chief Sheeler what he could tell me about these sailors to help me understand why they acted this way. I learned that they were both from the inner city of Detroit. One had a father in prison, and the other had never met his father. Both their mothers were on welfare. That didn't excuse them, but it put events in another light and gave me an opportunity. I thought of my own childhood, growing up with two caring parents in a small town in Pennsylvania. It seemed clear that neither of these young men had a positive male role model and I started to wonder if I could handle this situation in a way that offered them a different experience. This would depend on their behavior and what I learned and did in the initial hearing. Thus far, everyone involved had been lying. The white sailors didn't want to admit that one of them had muttered the word nigger in the confrontation, and the black sailors didn't want to admit that they had used the word too as part of their rap song. I needed the truth, so I sweated it out of them, literally. The hearing was in a room much too small for the 60 witnesses who were crammed into it. I turned off the air conditioning and started asking questions. It got hot, and then hotter. 3 hours later, one sailor cracked and told me exactly what had happened. Once the dam broke, everyone turned honest. I asked the two black sailors if they wanted to stay in the Navy. Yes, definitely, each of them answered. Okay, I said. I'm going to throw the book at you. Only if you want to stay. One more violation, though, gets you an e-ticket out of the Navy. The white sailor was a punk, and I startled the entire room by calling him such. All by himself, he could have avoided this whole sorry drama, and I wanted everyone on that ship to know that I knew that. I wanted them to know that I expect people to walk away if they can. I sentenced them and the white sailor who had been involved in the fight to the maximum punishment, short of dishonorable discharge. I restricted all three to the ship for 45 days, gave them 45 days of extra duty, and put them on half pay for 2 months. The whole process was draining. Nothing in my training had ever prepared me for this. I was in totally uncharted territory, and I knew that this one case could make or break my tour as CO. I walked back up to my cabin completely exhausted and drenched in sweat. I felt we had just successfully navigated through a minefield. Much like many black people in civilian society, the black members of the crew felt they were being discriminated against. Unbeknownst to me at the time, this would be the last disciplinary proceeding involving a young black male for the next 27 months, making a dramatic decline in offenses. Did we have a policy that said, turn a blind eye toward any violations by black males? Hardly. In fact, we tightened the standards for everyone. What explains the dramatic decline? Unity in the fact that our values determined how we led. Those young black men on Benfold were also here prior to my arrival. Only now did they have as level a playing field as possible. Instead of restraining people, we strengthened them. And we provided a positive model for all to emulate. I met with Master Chief Sheeler. I just tore those three sailors down, I said. Now it's your job to start building them back up. I want you to redeem these kids. Master Chief Sheeler called them into his office and said, you know what? You're on the captain's shit list. You can stay on it and suffer, if that's your choice, or you can get off and become responsible citizens, in which case, here's what you need to do. He worked with the two black sailors every day, while First Class Petty Officer John Rafalco and Chief Petty Officer Janice Harris supervised the white sailor. They both spent an enormous amount of time coaching him and setting an example for him. This mentoring process was becoming so successful that it was rolled out as a preventive measure to every crew member who was close to being in trouble. One night at sea, I saw the two sailors that Master Chief Sheeler was supervising, so I asked Sheeler to join me in challenging them to a card game in the mess decks after dinner. Naturally, they accepted. People walking through the mess decks were flabbergasted when they saw the four of us sitting around playing cards. We gave these young men big man status, and we were sending a message of forgiveness and acceptance. I felt it was my privilege to support these men. They turned around completely and became stars among their peers. Both were promoted, and both continued to do well. It is possible that if I had thrown them out of the Navy, they would have ended up in the criminal justice system. A year later, the white sailor asked me to re-enlist him for another tour in the Navy. I was sitting in my chair on the bridge wing and asked him if he could have envisioned this a year ago when I called him a punk. No way, he responded. But he was no longer a punk. He had matured into a fine young man. This experience taught me, and the whole crew, I hope, two valuable lessons. The first was the importance of taking people's background and circumstances into consideration before passing judgment on them. Not everyone starts out at the same place. But, with half a chance in some direction, most people left behind will catch up fairly quickly. The second was the significance of helping wrongdoers become better citizens instead of discarding them, as our society too often does. The effort we're putting into building prisons should be used instead to redeem people. I was determined to move away from the zero-defect mentality that, in my view, is a cancer spreading through too many organizations, including the military. I wanted people who screwed up on my ship to know two things. First, they will be appropriately punished. Second, they will get another chance. What's bad for women is bad for your ship. The Navy was trying to change its attitude toward women, as well as blacks. Benfold, for example, was one of the first Navy ships built from the keel up to accommodate women. But the failure of the diversity training program suggested that female fit quarters, although important, were not the primary issue. They did little or nothing to change hearts and habits. This was underscored by the resentment that our sister ship, USS Steatham, felt toward us. It angered that crew enormously that even though Steatham performed well, Benfold always performed better. Though we looked like twins, the ships were very different in spirit and achievement. For one thing, Steatham had an all-male crew, and some of its sailors derisively referred to the ships as his and hers. Frustrated by our superior performance, Steatham's sailors were constantly searching for something to beat us at. But in our view, we had another advantage. We were a mixed-gender ship. We encountered the same reaction when we got to the Persian Gulf in 1997. The Joint Chiefs of Staff ordered the aircraft carrier George Washington to join the Nimitz in the area. She brought two escorts with her, Normandy and Kearney. The captain of Kearney was an outstanding officer and had been XO of Shiloh when I relieved him in 1993. We had a friendly professional rivalry. If you picture Popeye, you will get a sense of him, an old salt who loves the sea and always has a sea story at the ready. He took a great deal of pride in calling his crew the Kearney Men. The ship had an all-male crew. Though he ran a great ship, Benfold's performance was better. Heck, in my opinion, in terms of morale and enthusiasm, Benfold was better. In the Gulf, Kearney's crew members didn't do as well on Tomahawk tests. They were very good, but were not at our level. Vice Admiral Fargo directed Benfold to write a report detailing how we met the requirements of firing the Tomahawks. We were happy to do so, but it may have irked Kearney's captain, who, along with his crew, had been bested by a mixed-gender ship. I had given a lot of thought to the role of women in the Navy, because the military is being pulled apart at the seams over the issue of integrating men and women into combat roles. I was determined from day one that women would be accepted on Benfold. A ship, just like an officer or factory, is a workplace where no sexual harassment is tolerated. Obviously, there are some jobs that women physically can't do, but those are relatively few. And truth be told, many men can't do them either. For example, when the USS Cole was the target of a terrorist bomb that blew a hole in her side, the ship nearly sunk. One of the required tasks to keep her afloat was to use wooden beams, which we use on the ship to shore up or keep the underwater hull from collapsing. These beams are extraordinarily heavy and you are working in a partially flooded space. It requires tremendous physical strength to maneuver them into place. Even some of the men could not have muscled the beams into place. But with everyone working as a team, each person contributing their part, they did a heroic job in saving their ship. The women sailors I found were every bit as motivated, if not more, when it came to achieving great results. I didn't set out to turn Benfold into a sociology lab. This was about combat readiness. The Navy is faced with a limited labor pool, and to exclude any portion of the population is just plain stupid. The Navy was staffed at 80% of its ideal strength, and a quarter of all new recruits are women. We could not get the ships out of port if we didn't accept women. After doing our best to bring Kearney men up to snuff, we left the Gulf and in late January 1998 pulled into Melbourne, Australia, where city security guards keep watch over the piers. One midnight, I came back from a night on the town and the guard stopped me to ask, "What's wrong with your crew?" Since I wasn't sure what he was getting at, I said, "Come again, mate?" He said he had never seen a better behaved or more disciplined crew than the one aboard Benfold. He said he usually saw only drunken sailors who were rowdy and difficult. I thanked him and beamed with pride. He was right, of course, and in my view, it was because we had women on board who we truly accepted as part of the crew. We didn't have the gender integration problems racking the rest of the military, for one reason. We treated everyone with respect and dignity, and required the same from our people. Once again, it was simply the right thing to do, but it also had a definite salutary effect on the crew's manners and behavior. Having accepted the women as equal, the men did not want to be shown up by them. Not only did their performance improve, they were also forced to grow up and stop being juvenile. The base commander in Bahrain, the first female base commander in the Middle East, was understandably skeptical about Benfold's claim to gender equality and came aboard to see for herself. Lo and behold, she found no credibility or gender gap. Our women, who ranked from seaman to lieutenant, were all doing phenomenally well. We had no fraternization cases that you hear so much about from the media. The base commander interviewed women sailors on every deck from stem to stern, and they all said the same thing. They loved serving on Benfold. I served with a lot of fine officers in my career, but my navigator, Lieutenant Jennifer Ellinger, was one of the best. Benfold was the junior ship when USS Gary and USS Harry W. Hill were deployed. Traditionally, the senior ships plot the course to and from the Persian Gulf, but because their crews were less competent, Jennifer steered us there and back. She performed superbly. In addition, she was the best second baseman I have ever seen on an officer's softball team. I could always count on her to get a hit when we needed one. Unfortunately, most of the male officers on the team were not as reliable. It was my dumb luck to have a group of officers who could not smack the ball out of the infield, so they never beat the chief petty officer's team. This was one of my biggest disappointments in my 2 years on Benfold. It was also one of Jennifer's, since she is as competitive as I. In the business world, there is a myth that women have achieved equality, when in fact a great deal of subtle harassment and discrimination still exists. Men resent competing with women for their jobs. In society at large, we have disturbing cultural trends, such as superstar rappers who advocate violence against women. I think we can all learn from Benfold's experience. I found some impressive fringe benefits to having women on board. The story of third-class petty officer Gussie Jones is just one example. Gussie's chance to shine came because of Benfold's program to give enlisted people the responsibility of being officer of the deck, the person in charge of the quarterdeck when the ship is in port. That person tends to security, logs in visitors, and keeps track of everything entering and leaving the ship. Since it is the visitor's first impression of the ship, the quarterdeck has always been a top priority. It's Navy tradition to tolerate no mistakes in what can be a hectic and demanding job, especially during busy shifts. For that reason, usually officers or chief petty officers stand this watch during the day. But I wanted to give junior people the satisfaction of handling more responsibility, and also to free up senior people for other jobs. Benfold began qualifying first and second class petty officers as officers of the deck. They made some mistakes, which we corrected without berating them. But in the long run, the program was such a success that other ships began copying it. We decided to go a step further and reach down to third-class petty officers. Up stepped 22-year-old Gussie Jones. After she passed the qualification, she was scheduled to take the midnight watch, the quietest possible time. "Nothing doing," I said. "Put her on from 0700 to noon, the busiest watch of the day." I wanted the rest of the ships to know that we had a third-class petty officer as the officer of the deck. On Jones's very first watch, my new boss, Commodore Jim Stavridis, unexpectedly showed up. Gussie announced his arrival on the public address system. In the Navy, arriving and departing senior officers are announced by their titles, not their name. and the number of bells suitable for their rank. 3- and 4-star admirals get 8 bells, 1- and 2-stars get 6, and commodores get 4. But harried, surprised, and nervous, Gussie gave Commodore Stavridis 6 bells and announced, "Destroyer Squadron 21, arriving." Hearing this in my cabin, I knew she had made a mistake. I also knew that my boss had probably shown up. So I raced down to the quarterdeck just as my officers were getting there. And before anyone can say anything, I grabbed the Commodore by the arm, shook his hand, and with a big grin said, "Let Benfold be the first to predict your selection to Rear Admiral next year." A huge grin broke out on his face. Gussie was embarrassed, but not humiliated. And most important, I sent a message to my officers on how to treat people. By the way, the Commodore was indeed made a Rear Admiral a year later. Gussie's second watch was 5 days later. It was the noon to 4 p.m. watch on a cold, rainy, windy day in San Diego, and the ship across the pier was attempting to get underway. When a ship leaves a pier, sailors from nearby ships pitch in to help cast off the mooring lines, and some of our crew were called for this duty. But the departing ship's officers were of the old hurry-up-and-wait school. They had the line handlers muster up and then stand in the rain for 45 minutes while the officers were warm and dry in the pilot house. Then, the ship developed an engineering problem which prolonged the delay. So Gussie Jones called my command duty officer, Lieutenant K.C. Marshall, to the quarterdeck. When he arrived, she said the sailors had been standing in the rain for nearly an hour. "Do you suppose we could bring them up here to stand under the awning to keep dry?" "Absolutely," said K.C., and proceeded to get some coffee and hot chocolate from the Benfold Cafe. How is it that 22-year-old Gussie Jones, standing her second watch, had the good judgment and common sense to bring those sailors out of the rain when the officers on the other ship did not? Chapter 12. Improve Your People's Quality of Life. I often get a feeling that corporate America, like the military, is headed for a nervous breakdown. We are now permanently wired to our work, wherever we are. Even on vacation, we're tethered to pagers, cell phones, and laptops so we can log in from the beach. This is okay in moderation. In excess, it eats away at the inner reservoir of spirit that people need to draw on when life gets tough. If you work 70 or 80 hours a week and never take time out for a work-life balance, the reservoir doesn't refill and soon you're running on empty. When times get tough, the body may be willing, but the spirit will be out to lunch. Long ago, one of Neptune's admirals must have decreed that working sailors are forbidden to have fun at sea. Our own admirals took the rule as gospel. No alternative had ever occurred to them. I wanted to change that. When I interviewed my sailors, I asked them not only how we could improve the ship's performance, but also how we could have fun at work. The responses were amazing. Fun with your friends makes a happy ship. One sailor said it would be neat if we had a stereo system, and maybe once a week at sea we could gather on the flight deck and watch the sun set while listening to jazz. We did that. At sunset every Thursday, a big crowd collected, men and women, officers and enlisted ranks, to listen to jazz as the sea darkened, which certainly contributed to the glue that held that crew together. Another sailor thought it would be fun if we could smoke cigars while we were out there listening to jazz and watching the sun go down. So we bought a humidor and laid in a supply of pretty good cigars. Thursday night duly became jazz and cigar night on Benfold. Yet another sailor suggested a happy hour every Friday night at sea. I was ready to break a lot of rules, but definitely not the one that banned serving alcohol on a ship at sea. Still, you can have happy hour without alcohol, or so I decreed. Every other Friday night, we gathered on the mess decks for a feast. Steamship round, buffalo wings, the best available shrimp. We also bought a karaoke machine. I made 2 stipulations. The first, which the crew unanimously approved, was that the captain would not sing, or even try. The second, reflecting a cultural failing of mine, was that there would be no country music. I can't bear the stuff, even through Walkman earphones, let alone playing on a karaoke machine at destroyer-level volume. But people were polite about the captain's eccentricity, and it was wonderful to hear my sailors laughing as they sat together singing karaoke, especially without all the sobs, twangs, and wails that they loved and I loathed. We tried to instill fun in everything we did, especially mundane, repetitive jobs such as loading food aboard the ship. Except in San Diego, where Irv Refkin's conveyor belt came to our aid, that was a chore we did by hand, and it was hard work. We decided that music would make the job go faster. With our huge stereo system playing great tunes, it was a whole new scene. Everyone danced and boogied to the music. The officers and chiefs supervising the workforce ended up pitching in themselves. Music seemed to make even the most boring task fun, a lesson that somehow escaped the U.S. Navy. Still, another sailor said, "Why don't we put a sheet on the back bulkhead on the flight deck and get a movie projector and show movies under the stars at night?" I thought it was a fantastic idea. Though we had put TVs and VCRs in every workspace so people could watch movies on their own, the flight deck idea took us back to the time when we all watched movies on ships as a single audience and shared the experience together. The throwback seemed to me a step forward in unifying my crew. So, we had Saturday night at the drive-in. We were in the Persian Gulf, 30 miles south of Iraq, and we showed a double feature every Saturday night. The first film was always a comedy, the second an action-packed thriller. We provided 300 bags of microwave popcorn as well as sodas. People brought their beach chairs, blankets, and pillows, lay out under the stars and watched a movie. Other ships sidled up to us and took positions 100 yards off our flight deck so they too could watch. The point was that having fun with your friends creates infinitely more social glue for any organization than stock options and bonuses will ever provide. Having fun is a notion you can apply to any workplace, anywhere. Not long ago, I proposed it to a conspicuously dour bank, and the managers looked alarmed. They said more or less, "Fun isn't allowed here. It goes against the culture of the organization." But one of the managers broke ranks. "Why don't we have laugh-in once a month?" she said. The others softened, albeit slowly, and the light finally dawned. So now, one day a month, the bank's once mirthless employees gather for a brown bag lunch and sit together watching reruns of TV classics like I Love Lucy and Gilligan's Island. These people had barely said a word to one another for days, if not decades. The last I heard, they were actually laughing. The first priority, good food. My parents came to San Diego to watch me take command of Benfold, and afterward, I invited them aboard for a 6-hour cruise. It was their first time on a ship, let alone on a ship I commanded, and I wanted them to love it. Unfortunately, when I took them for lunch in the officers' mess, we discovered it was chicken nuggets day. I don't know how you can ruin chicken nuggets, but these were hard, tasteless, and downright embarrassing. If this is what we were being fed in the officers' mess, I thought, what might my crew be eating? Food is extremely important on a ship. For all the promise of excitement and adventure at sea, there's a lot of monotony in the Navy with many days of rote performance and routine maintenance. Providing much more than subsistence, meals give people a chance to socialize and relax, and they provided me an opportunity to boost the crew's morale. Every Navy ship has a menu review board. Once a month, each of the ship's divisions, Benfold has 24, sends a representative to the board to talk about the menu. It often seems we have more meetings than we have people, and most divisions don't send their best to this one. Historically, it is a non-value-added event that was established for some reason that no one remembers, but aren't allowed to cancel since we get inspected on it. I showed up, unannounced, at the next meeting. On most ships, all hands stay alert to whatever the captain is doing, and word quickly spread that I was sitting in on the menu review board. Shocked, the two officers in charge of food, who had not planned on attending, showed up, and an earnest culinary discussion ensued. I listened and finally spoke up. "I have to tell you," I said, "the food on this ship stinks. What's the problem?" Everyone was taken aback at my bluntness. But I wasn't out to berate or punish anyone. All I wanted was to understand why the food was so terrible. The menu review board is typically chaired by the chief petty officer who runs the enlisted mess decks. In this case, the chief volunteered that she had some cooks who didn't follow the menu cards. So I got all the cooks together and told them that they were key players in my campaign to boost morale. I stressed the importance of following the menu cards and said I wanted their support. I wanted to support the cooks as well as everyone else. When I can build people up, their work improves and my own morale leaps. My approach with the cooks was to walk through the galley just about every other day, telling them how much I appreciated their hard work. And the food got a lot better. But with a limited palette of mostly inferior ingredients, the cooks alone could not solve the problem. I took my kitchen campaign a step further. Ever since Moby Dick was a minnow, Navy ships have been required to get bids from food purveyors and buy only from the lowest bidder. What began as an anti-corruption policy became a recipe for lousy food. Unless, that is, you are fond of nameless peanut butter that comes in big aluminum cans, and beef so fatty and tasteless that it's called mystery meat by the crew. While I was in the Pentagon, my boss, Secretary of Defense William Perry, had fought hard to get Congress to pass the Federal Acquisition Reform Act, which freed military people from having to make all purchases according to government standards. Although this was good government in action, it got no play in the media. That law allowed us to buy supplies on the open market and become shrewd shoppers in the process. If I wanted Skippy peanut butter, I could buy it. If I wanted good steak, I could get the best cuts. I directed my supply officer to cut cheap out of his vocabulary and replace it with quality. Buy Skippy if that's what the crew wants, I said, and make sure to ask if they want chunky or smooth. This is how I got the money to send 6 cooks to culinary school. Benfold ended up serving the best food in the Navy. Our Thanksgiving dinners were as good as the ones I had at home. Sorry, Mom. When I took command, I had 3 top priorities: to get better food, implement better training, and make as many promotions as I could every year. Though some people titter when I list food as number 1, the fact is that it raised morale and helped start the process of transforming our ship. Add to your crew's bottom line. In late August and September of 1997, we made our way from Hawaii to the Persian Gulf with memorable stopovers in Singapore and Thailand. We spent 30 of those days at sea aggressively training in the use of Tomahawk cruise missiles. Tomahawks, which can travel over 1,000 miles and land within feet of their target, are this country's primary artillery. I wanted the best deployment team in the Navy. Our training paid off. Benfold was the only ship in our 3-ship group that was Tomahawk capable. Hill and Gary weren't configured to carry Tomahawks. The closer we got to the Gulf, the more provocative Saddam Hussein became. We were ordered to speed up, leave Gary and Harry W. Hill behind, and get our Tomahawks in position as quickly as possible. The U.S. Navy doesn't issue rum to its warriors, but it does hand out incentive pay to those in harm's way, a region that then included the Persian Gulf. For being inside the Gulf, even for 1 minute of 1 day, a sailor's pay for that entire month would be tax-free. Our orders only said to reach Bahrain on October 3, 1997. But fortunately, they didn't tell us how to do so. With a speed of 18 knots, we could make Bahrain as directed. However, I figured that a speed of 24 knots for 2 days straight would get us just inside the Gulf at 23:59 on the night of September 30th, giving us the last minute of the month inside the tax-free zone and adding at least $350 to each crew member's paycheck. Never mind that it required us to be so far ahead of schedule that we only needed to do 5 knots for the next 2 days to make it to Bahrain as directed. I could have gotten slapped hard if I had gotten caught. As it happened, however, a new Iraqi crisis popped up on October 1st, and Vice Admiral Fargo ordered us to the Northern Gulf to help. No one ever thought to ask why Benfold was inside the Persian Gulf 2 days early. So now it can be told, Saddam did us a favor. Thanks to his threats, we added value for our battle group commander, and my sailors got a bonus in addition to paying no taxes in the month of September. In heavy times, lighten up. In early November 1997, we came very close to launching our Tomahawk missiles. It was a tense time. Kofi Annan, the United Nations Secretary General, was traveling around the Middle East trying to arrange a peace deal. Meanwhile, Saddam was threatening to throw out the UN weapons inspectors. We stood by, ready to shoot if the order came down. The media back home were making war sound inevitable. Still, it was a beautiful fall in the Persian Gulf, and one Sunday afternoon, with the thermometer showing 80 degrees, I decided we needed a break from the crisis. Benfold carried two small Zodiac boats with outboard motors, and we organized a boat race, using floats to set up a course alongside the ship. Each of the ship's five departments entered a team, and we started the races by blowing the ship's whistle. Zodiacs are pretty fast. They can hit about 40 miles an hour. To make the event even more festive, we had a cookout on the flight deck. My crew loved the whole thing, but the one who relished it most was the chaplain. Lieutenant Glenn Woods was visiting us from the carrier Nimitz. He loved the difference between our ship and Nimitz, which had several full-time chaplains and psychiatrists to deal with the problems of its 5,500-person crew. As a sideline, they occasionally visited other ships to see if pastoral help was needed. We gave Woods an office on Benfold and announced his availability for troubled souls. But his only takers, he told me, were people who came to ask if he needed anything. The chaplain got into the spirit of Zodiac racing. We put him in one of the boats as a crew member, and he refused to get out. He said he had never had as much fun in his whole Navy career. He was so delighted that I worried a bit about his sharing the story of our exploits when he got back to Nimitz. Technically, putting our boats in the water required clearance from Commodore Duffy. I told him that the boats needed maintenance work over the side, which was true, but I had not mentioned that racing would be part of the tune-ups. As I suspected, the chaplain was too full of good spirits to keep the experience to himself. Back on Nimitz, word spread like wildfire that even in these grave times, with war likely any day, Benfold was out having boat races. Sailors on the carrier said that if they ever got within 5 miles of Benfold, half of them would jump off and swim over because we were having such fun. Duffy never mentioned the races. Let the crew show off the ship. Next, we went to Australia. In every port, I ignored the elitist Navy rule that only distinguished guests can visit a ship. I saw no reason to forbid my sailors to invite their newfound friends aboard. In fact, I encouraged people to go out and make friends and do just that. Sometimes when I saw a sailor showing his or her pals around, I joined them and helped explain how the ship worked. My sailors made what seemed to me literally thousands of new friends, and I was struck by their eagerness to bring them aboard. They clearly felt enormous pride in Benfold. I often mused how wonderful it would be if corporations inspired such pride, so that employees viewed their workplaces not as hostile territory, but as showplaces they wanted their friends to see. If workers felt that kind of ownership, lots of labor problems would evaporate. I don't think I'm being naive. It happened on Benfold. Why not in any other organization? As we prepared to leave Melbourne, with the tugs alongside, I went down to the pier to make a final check on the mooring lines. I found a young woman crying uncontrollably. "What's wrong?" I asked, though I had my suspicions. "I can't believe how friendly your sailors are, and I just hate to see you leave. Especially Willie, who works in the radar room. Would you please give him a note for me?" When I got back on board, I made an announcement over the PA system. "Now hear this, Willie in the radar room. I have a note to you from a lady whose heart you broke. Report to me on the bridge." Willie duly appeared, blushing, and received his note as the whole crew cheered. From then on, he was considered a hero for having broken hearts beyond the call of duty in the Australian Theater of Operations. Maybe I should have awarded him a medal, not the Purple Heart, but the Valentine Cross, perhaps with a chocolate cluster. The secret of good work? Good play. After we had mastered refueling at sea, we decided to try something harder, nighttime refueling at sea. Our first attempt worked flawlessly. It was easier than I expected, and a lot more pleasant than parboiling under a hot Gulf sun. My sailors liked it so much that